Means Committee, Subcommittee on Public Safety for Monday, February 21, 2005. We are in a public hearing on Senate Bill 5525, the Public Defense Services Commission. And with us for this afternoon is Mr. Peter Ozan, Director of the Commission. Let the record show that we are opening the meeting without a quorum, and we hope that that will change shortly. And I will just also say for the record, this is a day when we have with us in the building hundreds, if not a thousand or two, parents and students from all over the state of Oregon to express their concerns about school funding. And I know that the various members are meeting with their constituents in hallways and offices and Capitol steps and probably in other places as well, and that explains some of the delays in members getting here this afternoon. With that said, does the LFO staff have any guidance or direction before we turn to Mr. Roseanne?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the only thing that I would mention is the fact that this is another judicial branch agency with a significant hole in its budget in terms of meeting its essential budget level or the operating funds necessary for it to meet its caseload.
And we'll be hearing more about that from the director. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Ozan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ms. Lamont, my name again is Peter Ozan. I'm Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission. I understand I'm the only one listed on the agenda, but I'd like to begin by introducing two gentlemen who, one of certainly needs no introduction, the Chief Justice, who is in charge of appointing the members of the commission, and then the chairman of the commission, Barnes Ellis. They will start off, and then I will spend a goodly portion of the afternoon going through our presentation. Chief, Mr. Ellis.
Thank you, Peter. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Wally Carson. I'm the Chief Justice, and according to the legislation that was passed by this body 3 years ago, the Chief Justice is an ex officio member of the Public Defense Services Commission. All that means is I hold it not because of me, but because of the office I hold, so the Chief Justice, whomever he or she may be, will be a standing member of the commission. I'll mention that it's a non-voting member of the committee, but then Barnes always says yes, but I get to appoint the members of the commission. So there's a little power balance there, at any rate. One of the things that I'm most pleased about is that where I think we are now, and with the help of a number of people, Ms. Lamont has been very helpful. We had the Engine at Defense as part of the Judicial Department, very ably assisted or directed by our Dan Christian, our then lead of the Indigent Defense in the State Court Administrator's Office. It had been our desire in the judicial branch to move Indigent Defense, deeming it to be a conflict, and the judges in charge move it to an independent organization, and now is. It was tried, and I think in 85 and 87, and failed miserably, and came back into the judicial department. We were determined to make this work, and with a lot of good help from a lot of people, we were able, I think, knock on wood, to make this system work. And it has surprised me in its effectiveness. I think morale has been higher in the system, both inside the Public Defense Services Office and also elsewhere. The members of the commission are directed by your legislation or the legislation in past to have a mix between lawyers and non-lawyers, those with experiences as district attorneys and otherwise. Mr. Barnes Ellis, that I'll relinquish the microphone here shortly, is a longtime friend. And he earned the position on this. I like to tell the story because in 1979 and 80, he was chair of the Commission on the Judicial Branch. It's the one that came together and directed through legislation the consolidation of the state takeover, if you will, of the judicial department. Therefore, the employees were, the staff were all county people, the judges were state, but everybody else in the building, in the courthouse, were county. And as of 1 January 1983, they became state employees. He was the architect and the leader of the commission. And one of the things they did is recommended that the state take over indigent defense. Therefore, it had been a county responsibility. And so I thought no good turn deserves not to be punished, so I asked him, because he was a director who very able and pushed us into indigent defense, that he ought to help us get out of the problem. And so Barnes graciously accepted being chair of the our task force that designed this program and now chair of our commission. Sean McCray is Eugene lawyer, and for some time, well, it was high in the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, but more importantly was the chair of the predecessor Public Defense Committee, which ran the state side of the program, and she is our vice chair. James Brown is another member. He was a district attorney from Benton County and a lawyer, and for a period of time served as attorney general, and now is back in private practice, a very able person, and has joined us as a representative with DA experience. Henry Chip Lazenby was in the governor's office and transitioned now in the Development Commission of Portland and is a table member. John Potter, I know John is here, is one of the non-lawyer members of the organization and also is executive director of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Janet Stevens, again, hooks back into history. She's one of the editors of the Ben Bulletin. And her father and my father were on the first committee, Public Defender Committee, in the late 50s or 60s that started us down this road. So she, too, is paying her penance for having family members involved in the Indigent Defense Program. And finally, Mike Greenfield. We're delighted to have Mike. Mike is a veteran in state government, served in a number of administrative positions, very high positions, and has joined us and has proved to be a very able member of our commission. And with that, I'm delighted to be here. I'll step back and try to be of any assistance I can. But we had a nationwide program to pick a director, and Peter was the unanimous choice of the commission, and we're delighted. I think we made a very good choice, as I think I did when I selected the chair. So I'll leave it to their hands, Barnes. It's up to you.
Thank you, Chief. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to meet with you in phase one of your work on public safety issues. And I want to make just a few brief statements by way of background of the Public Defense Services Commission, and then our Executive Director, Mr. Ozan, will speak in more detail. As Chief Justice Carson mentioned, the commission was created by the legislature, actually it was 4 years ago, in the 2001 session. And that followed a two-year study by a group also appointed by the Chief Justice, of which I was chair. And bringing indigent defense services under this new structure, really there were three principal factors in the legislation. First, we in the legislature felt that it was important to consolidate some fragmented pieces. Appellate services at that time had been handled by a group of full-time equivalent attorneys in a semi-autonomous agency. And trial-level services were contracted for by a subgroup within the state court administrator's office. There was no formal coordination between the two and no central leadership or central management. Bringing these two functions together under a strong executive structure was long overdue, and the last 2 years, when we've been under that new structure, have seen these agencies become successfully integrated. Second, many of our state judges were very uncomfortable with the role they were asked to play in selecting, appointing, supervising, and compensating attorneys on one side of what is supposed to be an adversarial process. In addition, many judges felt that growth in the cost of indigent defense was coming at the expense of other judicial department financial needs, and that clearly separating the budgets was appropriate. Our experience has been that largely removing the courts from Defense Services management has clearly proven to be a very good thing for the system. And third, creating a commission to serve as a board of directors overseeing a strong executive was hoped to bring a focus and direction to this important area with a view to both significantly improving the quality of those services and at the same time being good stewards of the taxpayers' money. The state first assumed responsibility for indigent defense in 1983. The passage of the legislation the chief referred to. And for the next 20 years, it frankly was something of a scramble just to find providers willing and able to do the work. In the 2 years we have now had with the commission in place and with the new management structure and team, I think we are making significant progress in upgrading the delivery of defense services. And as you know, those services are not limited to indigents charged with crime. They also include juvenile cases, both delinquency and dependency, parental terminations, and mental commitments. One of the fears of the defense community at the time the commission was created was that separation of this function from the courts would mean the loss of leadership by the Chief Justice. I'm pleased to report that just the opposite has occurred. Chief Justice Carson has been very actively involved in the work of the commission, and as he said, he serves as a non-voting member. That doesn't mean he's not a very active speaking member. And, of course, he does hold the ultimate power of appointment and removal of the members. He has attended literally every meeting of the commission, of which there have been over 20 since the last legislative session, and he brings the prestige of his office and the power of his own commitment to our work. His appointments to the commission reflect his strong personal desire that this be an effective body as an agent of change and a focus on an area once viewed as an orphan of state government. He has included commissioners, as commissioners, individuals with deep roots in and understanding of effective state government. He mentioned to you Chip Lazenby, Mike Greenfield, and before Mike we had John Yunker, all three very experienced. He's also included a former attorney general, prosecutor, and respected lawyer, and that's Jim Brown. Two people with strong ties to the provider community, that's John Potter, who's the executive director of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and Sean McRae, a practitioner from Eugene. And he's included two public members, myself from Portland and Janet Stevens from Bend. Now, I need not remind the members of this committee of the difficulties our state faced in fiscal year 2003. Who will ever forget the five special sessions, each cutting deeper into the muscle of state government as our state's economic fortunes continued to ebb? And because Public Defense Services Commission has no control over its caseload, that is largely determined and should be largely determined by police and prosecutors and the level of crimes committed, we were faced with the impossible task of providing increasing services in the face of a rapidly decreasing budget. As you know, the Chief Justice ultimately had to take the unprecedented step of closing the courts one day a week and curtailing court processing of a number of categories of less serious cases so that we might complete the biennium still able to provide counsel in the more serious cases. The Chief Justice took this glide approach to avoid hitting a wall for the last 4 months of that biennium. Even with those curtailments, it was extremely painful for the defense provider community to survive an abrupt drop in caseload and some significant displacements and impacts inevitably occurred. But there also was a significant positive that came out of these otherwise negative events. The principal positive was that every component of the criminal justice system, prosecutors, law enforcement, corrections, crime victims, courts, all came to understand in a very clear way that if any one component of the criminal justice system is left behind, each of the other components of that system simply cannot do their job. It was very gratifying to appear before this legislature with strong and sincere support for indigent defense services coming from police, from sheriffs, from the Attorney General's office, from district attorneys, from corrections, from victims advocates, and from judges. We are all part of a public safety system. And while our professional roles as advocates necessarily must differ, we are united in recognizing this overriding common interest. I hope we never again repeat the economic experiences of 2003, but I also hope we never again forget the lessons of that experience. A key player in that process, who was indoctrinated under fire, Ms. Roseanne was appointed in January, just as the session started, was our new executive director, Peter Roseanne. Our commission had conducted a nationwide search to find a strong executive director, and we were very pleased that by far the strongest candidate was a longtime Oregonian, himself a former defender, a former professor of criminal law, and a person with years of experience working across agency lines at both the state and regional levels on criminal justice and public safety issues. Mr. Roseanne has been the fulfillment of what we had hoped for when the 2001 legislation was passed, a strong and effective executive able to work with the entire criminal justice system and to bring focus and direction to the task of providing legal services to indigents so that our adversary system can work. He will outline some of the specific activities of the Commission and of the Office of Public Defense Services. And I've tried hard to keep all acronyms out of that statement, even though Senator Winters isn't here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman Ellis, for those comments. And I turn now to my committee members for any questions or comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only, you think it was the right decision of what we're doing now, and even in spite of what the legislatures did to you in a couple of years ago, and is, we haven't really gotten into this, so we're going to get under the chair's leadership. We'll get into it in more detail, but the governor's already recommending less this year, too, but it doesn't, is that a significant amount that he's recommended? If you'd like to comment on the governor's recommended budget, I think it'd be appropriate, Madam Chair.
I'll make a quick comment, and then Mr. Roseanne can comment more in more detail. I think the structural decision in the legislation in 2001 was right. We can't control the funding levels. Obviously, we would much prefer to get the full budget that we had sought. And in 2003, frankly, the legislature did reasonably well by us, but we ended up with a cut because of the taxpayers. Obviously, we are disappointed that the governor has asked for a across-the-board cut. We hope that the economics of this session will permit restoration. All I can say is I think the new structure, we're using the funds we're given as well as we know how, and I think we are making significant progress in upgrading the quality. But there does come a time when if in this kind of system, and I think it's the largest contracting system in state government, if you keep cutting back and we keep having to ripple effect that to the providers, And really what that means is whole organizations hire people on an expectation of at least a minimal level of cases they're going to be processing. When you start cutting back time and again and the compensation levels are so much less than those same people could get in private practice, And so many of them come into the practice with large debt loads. I mean, that's a shift from a generation earlier. I mean, when my generation got out of law school, that just wasn't there. We see now a lot of really promising young lawyers have the idealism and the energy and the desire to be in the defense area, but if they have $80,000 or $100,000 of student debt, it's extremely difficult. So there is a price that's paid, and as we go forward over time, and if we're not able to pull the level of funding up, that price is going to start reflecting itself in a diminished quality that I don't think any of us wants to see.
Representative Hanna.
Just on that note, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the turnover rate of the attorneys within the commission?
Well, there's two levels I think need to address. The full-time lawyers at the state level, there are 25 of those. The turnover rate there is about 5 to 8% a year. So there is turnover there. The largest group that we deal with are the trial-level lawyers all across the state. Roseburg has one of the best firms handling defense work. The one I'm most familiar with is the largest of those. That's the Metropolitan Public Defender. That is an organization that does experience not just significant turnover, but the problem you face is attracting new people into the system, given the economic constraints that we're looking at. And there's about a 25% differential between what those trial level lawyers are paid and what their equivalent at the DA's office is paid, and that's real money when you're at that level. My belief is the turnover rate at MPD is higher than what I said for the Legal Services Division at the state level. It's probably 12% a year.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnott.
Thank you, Manager. I'm not sure that we could wait till we get the further presentation, but while I'm thinking about it, your contract lawyers are by individuals. Have we looked at doing firms where they could maybe, it's not as big an impact on them if you're using some, you know, having your young attorneys do this work?
We actually have four types of providers we contract with, and individuals is by far the smallest percentage. That's less than 5%. The largest single group are community defenders. These are nonprofit entities with full-time lawyers. The largest is in Portland, but there's a very large one in Lane County. That's about 38% of the total caseload is handled through those community defenders. And then we have private firms that we contract with. Jim Arneson from your area is the one I was mentioning a moment ago. We then have a unique to Oregon concept, or reasonably unique, which is a consortia. And we've actually encouraged the formation in various areas of the state of lawyers pooling together for this purpose. They provide unified management within the region that they serve. So we'll contract with the consortium. It has another advantage, which is they're not subject to what's called the unit conflict rule, so that we get less disqualification for conflicts using the consortia. And then the last area is individuals, some of whom we contract with on a bulk caseload basis, some of which in some counties are still handled on a court-appointed list. So the answer, long-winded answer, is we do deal with a range of structure of lawyers. We do deal with firms, and we do try to encourage some ability to absorb ups and downs in the caseload by those groups that we deal with. But take the community defenders. These are dedicated resources only able to function in the defense area. They're nonprofit. They can't, go out and do cases. So cutbacks or abrupt cutbacks, which they can't plan for, are very damaging to those.
Very good answer.
The record should now show that we have a quorum with the arrival of Senator Devlin. Representative Hansen is ill today. Senator Winters is excused for another appointment, though she should be arriving shortly. I would like to ask an additional question, Chairman Ellis. Going back to your comment about how every component of the criminal justice system came to understand that under the budget constraints, as you put it, they all had to work together, that understanding that none of them can be left behind. They're all linked. What are the challenges then, given what seems to be the public's lack of understanding? Given the public's, the taxpayers' decisions around Measure 28, Measure 30, that would suggest to me that the same level of understanding isn't there on the part of the public. You care to comment?
Well, I'm not going to argue that we have as well-educated a public in this area as we'd like. But I think the public does understand the importance of public safety. What they may not understand is the role that indigent defense plays in making the system of public safety function as it was intended to. And I'll agree with you. I think we have an education job to do there. But the point I was making is in the 03 session, I think it really was true that, a lot of people think that because defenders and DAs are adverse to each other in the courtroom, that they're adverse to each other in other ways. And what really happened 2 years ago was, I thought, a remarkable statement that the DAs fully understood without adequately funded defense, they can't prosecute. The police understood that without adequately funded defense, it doesn't do any good to put people into the system that can't deal with them. So that was the message that I thought came across.
I appreciate you clarifying the point. And again, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for your service chair of the commission. And now we turn to Mr. Ozan to start walking us through the material.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Peter Ozan, Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission. If I may take just a moment to respond to a couple of the questions. I think that one was initially Representative Wisnant, Madam Chair, directed to both of us. And I did want to say that Representative Wisnant, as to the structure or organization, I personally believe, though I wasn't part of the design of this architecture, that it really is probably the leading way to proceed with public defense in the country. In fact, there's currently a national study chaired by Vice President Walter Mondale, in which they're looking at systems of delivery across the country. And they're asking us, as really one of the national models, to appropriate separation from the judicial branch, and yet we're part of the judicial branch in the sense that the judges don't pick the lawyers, they make the determination of eligibility, and then we provide the lawyers. That's a very good balance. And then secondly, I believe this, what is essentially a strong board of directors. I'm the CEO of the organization, but the board brings all of that rich business experience, government experience, and judgment to bear, and so I'm in constant communication with them. I think it's the exact right way to deliver these services in an effective way to manage it. Second part of your question, where do the governor's recommended budget put us? And I'll certainly walk through the numbers, but basically on a budget, a maintenance budget, we call it the Chief Justice's maintenance budget of about $176 million, the governor's recommending a cut of $15 million at the 9% level. And as I say, I'll walk through the numbers with you, Representative, but later. But really what that means for the system is that we won't be able to provide lawyers for about 32,000 cases out of a caseload of about 170,000, 180,000. And as we faced during the period of time in the end of 2002-2003, the crisis that everyone's alluded to, we simply will have to stop providing lawyers in a number of criminal cases sometime in the spring of 2007. I'll give you the as closely as I can predict with the assistance of our management team about that. But essentially, the governor, frankly, has put us in that hole once again. And then, of course, you're asking, we will describe to you what another 10% cut would be. And I will walk through those numbers. I know you don't want, and I promised to you in previous proceedings not to whine, but I do want to give you the facts and the likely consequences. And I believe, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, that ultimately, and I know from conversations with the committee, Representative Wisnant, you've been aware that that we need to, one of the challenges is to right-size the organization as well as to downsize or upsize the public defense system. And right-sizing has to take into account the effects that our cutting our budget would have on the entire public safety system.
Mr. Ozan, do you want questions as you go along, or would you take them at the, what works best for you?
Well, Madam Chair, I know that I'm promising to get through today, and I believe we can do that.
Okay.
I have no preference. It's up to the Chair. I'm happy to respond to questions as we proceed. It shows me, as we lawyers like to say, that we have a hot panel, an interested, engaged group on the committee, so
let's
I'm happy to take questions.
Whichever
the chair prefers.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I apologize to the chair and members in the members of the committee for being late, and to people in the audience. If more hours in this building equaled more dollars to be able to fund some of these budgets adequately, I'd, it would be a very nice occurrence. But on a daily basis, it seems that more hours equal less dollars to fund things adequately. If you fell short in terms of the number of cases you could process, you would obviously have to probably go through some sort of prioritization, just as the Chief Justice discussed the prioritization of cases in terms of timing for cases through the judicial system. Have you given that any clear thought as to how cases would be prioritized? I mean, obviously, I think you'd take your lowest criminal cases. I do not know how it would impact your some of your other potential caseloads other than criminal. But
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, an excellent question that we've been pondering since I've been here for over 2 years. We reached the conclusion, and the answer is, and I would, if I were sitting where you're sitting and the other members of the committee, it wouldn't satisfy me, but we don't have the ability or the statutory authority to do what the Chief Justice did. If you look, for example, what you're referring to for the other members of the committee, on page 18 of our materials, it shows what you were alluding to, Senator Devlin, and that is essentially what a rational person, I would presume, with the authority would want to do, which is allocate cases, giving counsel to the most serious cases. I'm looking now at the bottom of page 18. It says, during the 2001-03 biennium, a $9 million shortfall, which happened right at the end of the biennium, by the way, resulted in the courts deferring appointment of counsel during a four-month period of time in the following case types. And the less serious that are listed here were the cases that were counsel was deferred in until the next biennium. So that, I think, is what you were alluding to.
Yeah.
Have we thought of that?
So a follow-up to that, Madam Chair. Follow-up is, you would have to depend upon the courts making that judgment again to make that decision where they would have counsel appointed or not appointed.
That's right, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin. If the courts were, and I certainly won't speak for the courts, and the Chief is here, and I welcome the Chief to speak to that, although I believe he did during the presentation by the Judicial Department, which is, it's one thing to prioritize and defer counsel for a four-month period of time at the end of the biennium. It's another thing to start out at the beginning of a biennium and talk about a two-year period of deferring cases. There's not only the speeder trial issues, there's the federal litigation that was brought by prosecutors and defenders last biennium, in which the court said, well, last time the issue was moot because the legislature appropriated money, but really inferred to us lawyers reading that opinion that when it comes the next time, they may not approve of anything like deferring cases. So without risking which I am, I suppose. The chief can speak to for himself, but I've heard him say that the courts will not defer cases because of the both the unmanageability and the questionable constitutionality of that fix. And then, as I said, as far as we're concerned, we don't have the authority either by statute to make those determinations, nor do we obviously have the authority to direct judges to do anything. So we're faced with the reality of when the money runs out, the money runs out. In other words, we won't have money to provide counsel in the most serious homicide case or the drunk driving case or the theft 2 case, whichever one considers the less serious case. We will simply run out of money several months before the end of the biennium. So we have agonized about it. We know it's not an answer people are happy with, but it's really the answer we think we can give based on our authority.
What flexibility do you have with the appellate side, Mr. Pozan?
Well, Madam Chair, the flexibility, maybe I want to be sure I understand your question, but I'll answer on face, but if you'd like to, if I'm missing your point, we really have the same issue. We have a set number of lawyers. It's a division called the Legal Services Division of the Public Defense Services Commission. That used to be formerly the State Public Defender's Office. And there are 25 lawyers who handle the appeals in all criminal cases where a person has been appointed counsel. And we have been working, and I'll allude to our success in reducing the backlog in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court with those 25 attorneys and what I'll call some hand-to-hand management, looking at lawyer work plans, measuring lawyer performance, and really reducing the caseload. If we lose lawyers and the caseload continues to grow as it has from biennium to biennium, we again, that backlog in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court will grow again. And I, from memory, I hesitate to give you numbers, but it's like we count cases over 210 days from the date a transcript is prepared until the first brief is filed. 210 days now is a delay. Those delays we estimate with cuts in the budget that we're projecting here today from the governor and then the 10% cut, that those time periods will slip to over a year, and the backlog will probably double. So I don't believe, unless I'm missing something in your question, Madam Chair, that we really have any flexibility. We've got a fixed number of lawyers. We've got demand based on the number of cases that are filed by prosecutors and juvenile and criminal, and we just deal with the cases as effectively as we can.
And so, Mr. Ozan, you're also drawing our attention not only to the text at the bottom of page 18, but to those three bullet points on at the top of page 19, which summarize what is required by statute and by the state and federal constitutions. With regard to needing to provide the services, there is no flexibility.
Madam Chair, exactly. You obviously, I appreciate you having read ahead and read the materials, and you've essentially identified the point I was making in response to Senator Devlin. The federal and state constitution and the Oregon statutes along tell us what to do, and there are obligations to provide counsel based on the Constitution and those statutes when a crime or a juvenile case is brought. We have no ability to adjust, defer cases like the Chief Justice did. And we simply have to pay out our money and compensate counsel until we run out of money. As I say, under the scenarios that are before you today, it will be several months before the end of this biennium, this coming biennium, when we will run out of money. That essentially, the committee has already brought me to the bottom line today. That is really where we are.
Senator Devlin?
This doesn't make sense.
Just, thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I can ask the obvious question. If you end up with the governor's budget,
three and this one's two,
and I know your difficulty in finding counsel at your current rates in many jurisdictions, what would prevent you from adjusting your rates down even lower in order to make your budget actually meet your anticipated caseload, other than the realities of finding counsel that's willing to work?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, will nothing other than, as you say, the forces of the market. In other words, I was going to use, and I appreciate all these questions, I was going to, when I had some introductory comments, I was going to use the Chief Justice's metaphor that he used about the stick being pushed down on the airplane or pulled up. And if you think of us as an airplane, we are flying right at the edge of the treetops. And if you think of our budget as that stick, if you push it down, we're going to crash land into those trees. And what I mean by that in response, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, is that we can cut our rates now. We're, just to give you a sense, we had a case recently where the newspapers asked me in a death penalty case what the two lawyers were getting paid because there was a lot expended. It was a very complex case. And these were lawyers who were at the top of their game. One had 30 years of experience handling death penalty cases. You have to be the very best. The other had over 15 years experience. One was earning, the less experienced was $72,000. The more experienced one was $76,000. Now that's a living wage, I'm not saying, but if you think about it, in Mr. Ellis's law firm or in my law firm or in Portland, that's less than a beginning first year lawyer would be making in a large firm that knows nothing. So we're paying just a wide variation between what can be obtained in private practice and what can be obtained or what we can provide for these lawyers. The prosecutors, by the way, and many times I'll say prosecutors don't make enough. That's a separate issue. In that particular case, the prosecutor, the senior prosecutor, made $106,000, as I recall. It was over $100,000. And the junior prosecutor associate was about in the mid-90s. So we lag behind the prosecutors. We lag behind the market. We could reduce our rates, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin. I've emphasized in the materials, and you probably noticed, the consequence would be we wouldn't get any choices. And where it's particularly difficult is in the rural areas and in juvenile court. And just as an aside, I meant to earlier before the questions, I want to introduce Catherine Elward, who will come up in a few moments and talk with us. She is in charge of the Contract and Business Services Division. And I also wanted to acknowledge, for those of you who have been here for a while, Ann Christian in the back of the room, who is really Catherine's predecessor, who we continue to confer with. I meet with her monthly about these issues. But Catherine, one of the wake-up calls for me, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, was when I went out to some of the regions and said, you know, this kind of performance won't do in a juvenile case, for example. We found that a lawyer might not be seeing their client regularly. I wanted to say, well, we'll just do business with someone else. And Catherine kind of nudges me in the elbow and says, Peter, there is no one else. And where we are in the rural areas, because of the notion that, you know, it's like medicine, a lot of people don't want to move to the rural areas to practice law. They came from the big city. They don't want to go to the rural area. And in the juvenile area, it's certainly improved over my 30 years of law practice, but still there is a small number of people, relatively small, who want to do the work. And again, in the rural areas, it's very difficult. So if we reduce those rates, what will hit the wall is in the rural areas and in juvenile court, where we just won't have any lawyers who are interested in doing the work. And then finally, I want to add a twist to that, to your question, really, and it goes to the 2002 fiscal crisis. The community of public defense lawyers, whether they're in members of consortium, whether they're in nonprofit defenders or more, whether they're in private law firms, watched carefully and were hurt very badly by that 2002 crisis, and they wonder if it's going to happen again. If it happens again, it's not just the low rates, it's the predictability of the income flow. For example, when I started practicing law in Oregon in 1974, I opened an office with two other people. I took court appointments. They didn't pay a lot, but it was a revenue stream, as we used to say, paid the light bill while I tried to get other cases in the office to make a living. And our lawyers do that sort of thing. If that income stream occurs like it did in 2002, 2003, it suddenly ends, a lot of the people who are interested in doing business with us, in part, won't do it anymore, because not only are the rates low, but they're unpredictable. So in sum, yes, reducing the rates is certainly an option. It's just that at some time the market will push back.
Representative Wisnant, did you have a...
No, Madam Chair, I guess Representative Hannah and I are really having trouble trying to reconcile the numbers with the bill and what's in here, which I said I don't want to get ahead and jump ahead, but we're just trying to, we're not reconciling our financials, right?
Well, let's take care of that that question right now with Ms. Lamont.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And I apologize. I think that when I revised the this analysis, I dropped the language on the summary language that you would have seen with the judicial branch agencies, which noted that on the summary page, on the first page, what is listed is the governor's recommended budget, which is not the cumulative total from the Chief Justice's request. And there was language originally in there that noted that the governor, while taking no position on these cuts, had made a reduction to the essential budget level. And so I think if you're trying to get...
Well, Madam Chair, Mrs. Mott, what we're saying is legal services in go to Annex E.
Appendix E.
Those three numbers don't match at all with what the bill is. Now this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have not done that analysis. The numbers in the bill do match with what's in the judicial branch's recommended budget.
Yeah,
I believe. Go ahead, please.
Pardon me. Madam Chair, Ms. Lamont, Representative Wisman, if it would help, I could go through at least our documents. I'm not.
And then
maybe after I explain where we started. In fact, we work with Ms. Lamont to try to show the starting point with the governor's budget and then the 10%. So if I can walk through those numbers, perhaps that would be. I'm not saying I can reconcile because I'm not sure I know all the documents that you have before you, but at least I can give you an explanation of the bottom line, and then we can go from there.
That would work. Let you get to your presentation. And members, we also have time tomorrow to carry this discussion forward. So,
Madam Chair. Unless I'm wrong, and Catherine can correct me, what you have on the appendix is the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget. What you have in the analysis and on the bill is the Chief Justice's recommended budget, which includes policy packages. And that's the primary difference.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, and I won't take a lot of time. I know you're trying to get started, but I think
this is not a problem.
Where Representative Wisnett and I were confused, and I think is helpful to everyone, and we've kind of gotten close to the explanation. But if you look at the public defense, this document, the summary, and you look at the actual bill in bill form, our problem was that we couldn't reconcile because we were looking at the governor's recommended budget and trying to come up with the totals here. But if you do look at the pages, as Ms. Lamont said, the subtotals for each of the divisions, they do match the totals in the bill. And that's where you...
Sure.
So now you know what we're looking at, too.
Yes, and I, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I certainly, again, happy to have the questions. Let's cut to the bottom line. I could drone on about the agency, although there's some things I'd love to tell you about it, but you're here to work with the budget. I'm happy to respond to that. I'd ask Catherine Aylward to come up. She's the chief budget officer and certainly can help me. But having not studied the document Representative Hanna is referring to, I don't want to make more of a hash of it. I'd still like to proceed with the documents I'm familiar with, and then we can, with Catherine's help, maybe we can clear it up, or Ms. Lamont. Sounds like you have, Representative Hanna, a handle on it anyway. But I would like to go through the appendix E, which has our budget documents. And here what we tried to do is show the impact of the governor's budget on the Chief Justice's recommended budget or maintenance budget, and then the impact of 10% more cuts. Again, to give you a sense, as Representative Wisnan first asked, you know, are you happy with where you are, where you'll be? So let's start, if I may, at page E1 of Appendix E. We've broken down, without any policy packages, the three components of our division services. See it as department or program activity, column three is, unfortunately, it's an acronym, and I don't know if Miss Piggy will punish me for reading acronyms, or but there's an acronym in there, and it stands for Legal Services Division. It's not the hallucinogen, it is the Legal Services Division, and that provides appellate representation, and the Chief Justice's maintenance budget, we're calling it, for that function is $6,129,905. And for the same in the total fund column, column 11, we have 37 positions. The 9% reduction that would be the Chief Justice's reduction of the Chief Justice's maintenance budget, and you can see the asterisk down here, there's a detail later. This is essentially the 9% cut the governor imposed. Is the amount of $551,000 and change. And then the other two components, the Public Defense Services account is the second item. That's the contracting services. That's the $166 million. The cut of 9% is almost $15 million over in column five, and so forth. There, the administration, that's the office, the third item, that the Contract and Business Services Division that Catherine administers the Public Defense Services account. That's the 21 people, and really only about six who manage and negotiate the contracts and monitor them, six people that run that function. There is a $350,000 cut that the governor would impose on the maintenance budget. And then the next page has essentially the consequences of those cuts, E2. $551,000 to appellate representation would mean a cut of 4.5 FTE and a reduction of personal services and 14% the inability to provide appellate representation and 14% of the current caseload and so forth. So that is the first pass, if you will, of the cuts the governor imposed on the Chief Justice maintenance budget. I believe I saw a question, Madam Chair, that perhaps I should stop. I've got my dollar bills out for Piggy.
Was there a question? Representative Hannah.
Again, I just want to make sure everybody understands what we're looking at, because this gets confusing. But the first page within there, again, remember what we're looking at, doesn't match the budget total page, because we're looking at a 9% reduction from the Chief Justice budget. The second page shows the 10% reduction from the governor's recommended budget. So you can't reconcile. Those two don't reconcile on the front page of this piece. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does everybody get that? All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it actually does reconcile. I'm sorry, E3 does reconcile to the governor's recommended budget summary on
right.
The LFO analysis.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes,
I understand that part, but I want to make sure we knew, because you look at the first one and then you look at this page and you go, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to get the second page to make it.
Our job, Representative Hannah, is to unpack the information that is being presented to the fullest possible understanding of each and every member on the panel. And so I encourage you, just as I encourage all members, to keep asking questions and keep questioning your own assumptions and the assumptions that are being presented to us. Mr. Ozan, I see a phrase on page E2 that is the impact of reductions, that second box on column 14, reduction to services and supplies.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Inability to provide representation for approximately 32,000 cases. That's the 32,000 you were referring to earlier in your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Disruption to the public safety system, including dismissal of cases for lack of counsel.
That's certainly, Madam Chair, what we're saying there is if the courts aren't at least we anticipate, if the courts aren't willing to defer appointment of counsel 2 years, the biennium, or some substantial period longer than the last time, 4 months, that both a statutory and a constitutional speedy trial provision attaches, and the courts are faced with something, either rounding up counsel off the street or dismissing cases. So that is our best effort as lawyers. Again, we can't speak for the courts, but that's a likely scenario, would be dismissal of cases.
Right.
And, of course, federal court intervention, probably some litigation from the Ninth Circuit would be involved at some point.
It's important to get that point also onto the record. There's the impact of the reduction, and then there are the consequences as a result of the consequences to the state, meaning the legislature, if such a reduction were to take place.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on your question, then if you take back to the two different budget scenarios, as Ms. Lamont mentioned, that on E3 we have the what we've called the governor's recommended budget, which has the 9% cuts. It also lists on page E3 our policy options with zeros in column 5, because the governor didn't approve of any policy option packages. And the other totals in 5 are essentially the totals derived after the 9% is deducted in the previous documents that we've been talking about, E1 and E2. And then we take off another 10%, as this committee has directed us to do, and we come up with total reductions in column 15 of another $16 million. And as to your question, which is you were referring to cuts in the funding of legal representation in the contract division, that is the Public Defense Services account, and the 32,000 cases, if you turn to page E4, again, this is showing the effect of the cumulative cuts, the first 9% and then another 10%, totaling $15,137,000, as you can see in column 11. Again, reductions to services and supplies, together with reductions necessitated by the governor's recommended budget and inability to provide representation for approximately 64,000 cases. So essentially, the 10% additional cut it doubles the impact, as it does, by the way, on the appellate caseload for our legal services division. We figure the impact will about double, and so it will double the caseload backlog in the courts of appeal and the Supreme Court.
Understood.
You could quantify. Pardon me.
No, go ahead. Finish your point.
And I was just discussing this with Ms. Elward before, in preparation for this. To this hearing, and she reminds me that we spend about $6.5 million a month to handle the caseload, and you can do the math. You know, $15 million is about 2.5 months where we won't have money to pay for lawyers in cases. $30 million will be about 5 months, and you back that out from the end of the biennium, that's when we're going to run out of money, is another way to look at it. So you can either look at numbers of cases or time. In any event, as you point out, Madam Chair, unfortunately, and this is why we could fill the room last session with district attorneys and sheriffs, we will bring the public safety system to a halt by virtue of not being able to provide counsel. That will be certainly in the initial prosecution of crime. It will be in those critical juvenile cases, delinquency, dependency, termination of parental rights, civil commitment, and appeals in all of those cases. All of those things will be stopped. And another less understood, though I know some of you who have corrections background will understand this, Oregon is unique in the ability of parole and probation officers to control the approximately 35,000 offenders in the community. It's called administrative sanctions. If Peter is under supervision and he violates his supervision by hanging out with the wrong crowd or taking drugs or alcohol, my probation officer will call me in and say, look, Peter, you can either go before a judge, and the judge will hear the violations and make a determination, or you can go down to the jail with me, and I'm going to take you in there for 2 days while you cool off and get your life straightened out. This is a very unique, powerful instrument that Oregon uses. I support it as a citizen. But that threat is no good if there is no lawyer to be available for that probation violation hearing with the judge, and every offender knows that. In other words, the probation officers lose the power to control and manage that 30,000 members, 30,000 offenders on probation and parole. So there's a number of ripple effects here that you were asking about, impacts when we run out of money that have only been anticipated or only been experienced as a result of those cuts in 2002. We don't have to anticipate them anymore. We know what happens.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, just a comment and just a clarification. Being the member on the committee that was here in the last session and sitting through those hearings in March and April, I believe, and having district attorneys come in and testify in favor of funding indigent defense, and sheriffs come in and testify in front of indigent defense, and chiefs of police come in and testify in favor of indigent defense, and particularly some of the sheriffs and the chiefs of police saying that basically they didn't believe they would ever be doing this in their life, but because the cases that they were bringing forward to the courts were not being prosecuted, I think they made a fairly clear case. I think our difficulty here is trying to figure out a way to fund what is an essential level and trying to determine just what that essential level is. I don't think there's really that much confusion here, and I think it goes beyond Representative Hanna's questions about the budget, but it appears like we have, at least we don't have the first one before us. We have the proposed budget, which was at one level, plus policy packages. That was the proposed budget. Then we have the governor's budget, who did not fund any of the policy packages and reduced the items by 9%.
Correct.
Then we have the Chief Justice's essential budget, which I think restores the 9%. And then we have the 10% reduction, which is just part of our process, from the governor's proposed budget. So it appears like we have four different potential budgets. And I know we'll be discussing the policy items, but I don't know how we would fund any of them. But I'm just saying that it appears that there are so many different budget figures that people have seen, because if they go in and look at the governor's, you know, large book, they will see the much larger numbers, and then in very small italics below it, it will say, well, I have forwarded the governor's, or I forwarded the Defense Services Commission's proposed budget. I've only reserved this amount of general funds to fund it. So I think that's part of the confusion sometimes that the committee has about this, is trying to settle on what the real numbers are. And I guess the real numbers are the essential budget level and how close we could get to funding that level.
Well, I think we have, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think I see Ms. Lamont's going to help us out. We were really trying to eliminate the first scenario as essentially academic. As much as we respect and work with the Chief Justice to come up with our initial budget with all the policy packages, we wanted to cut to the chase and eliminate one and really focus on the Chief's maintenance budget cut by 9%, giving you the governor's budget. Then you look at the governor's budget and what's the impact of that. And then, as this committee has asked, what happens when you cut another 10%? So there's really, we've tried to pare down to two budgets, and in the translation here, we've obviously created some confusion apparently, but I'll let Ms. Lamont help us untangle it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and unfortunately the LFO process adds complexity that probably doesn't help either. It has been the LFO practice to bring forward for the subcommittee's information the recommended budget, which includes the policy packages. But the issue in front of this committee, in my opinion, is the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget, which you don't see anywhere except on E1. Because the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget is built on the mandated caseload projections for this agency. So it does include some of the inflationary adjustments, which we could talk about, but it is primarily driven by assumptions about what will happen with the caseload. And so that, from my perspective, needs to be where the committee starts its discussion. And then the governor's budget, of course, is a 9% reduction to that maintenance level budget.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ozan,
and this is rough, somewhat rough, but the 0103 budget to the, and that's including the reduction, so the $152 million to the legislatively approved budget of $166, that's a 9.2% increase. If you went from $166 to the Chief Justice's recommended budget of $187,188, that's a 12.8% increase. Do you have a good feel for where that's going? I mean, when we go back and talk to our constituents and say, you know, you're going to have a annual rate increase of close to 5% or 5 or 6%, what are we going to tell them that the primary cost drivers are, and what's your longer-term projection for what happens here? Because when you start looking at a 12% increase for the biennium and you say, okay, guys, I'm going to take a deep breath and we're going to take a shot at this, what's it going to do next time? It's hard to come back and say we're going to keep having 12% biennium increases, and that's where I think people start to come against the wall. Maybe you can help us
Mr.
a little Roseanne, with that.
Before you respond, I'm going to ask Ms. Lamont to respond, and I'm going to ask members to pull from your notebooks a document that is titled Public Defense Services Commission. It's page 3-1.
It's, Madam Chair, it is the analysis that Ellicott did of the restoration of the final piece of the restoration of the ballot measure 30 reduction in the emergency board. And the reason I wanted members to have this is that there have been enormous fluctuations in how this budget was allocated because of the reductions that were taken during the 0103 biennium and the deferral of cases into the 0305 biennium. And then the ballot measure 30 reductions and restoration. And so the purpose of the chart is to essentially show where that budget actually is in terms of overall growth and what that reflects in terms of the projected caseload. So I hope that helps to clarify what is actually occurring with this budget, because it's a little bit confusing given the numbers and the adjustments that were made.
Madam Chair, I'll try to answer that Representative Hannah's question. First of all, $186 million roughly, Representative. 11.6 million of that are policy option packages. So I would tell your constituents that with the advice of the commission, my staff, my recommendation is to improve the system and to ensure the continuity and accessibility of lawyers going forward through your term and the term of my children and yours. We should fund those policy packages. However, we already know that this is not probably the session where you have the money to build for the future. So we're not really talking about policy packages with you or your constituents. So that takes $12 million, Representative Hannah, out of the $186 to get us down to more of an essential policy package, essential maintenance budget. Now, I would commend to you, if you hadn't had a chance, Representative Hannah, Madam Chair, because I know all of you, it's quite clear, are studying this in detail, Robin Lamont and the Legislative Fiscal Office prepared a wonderful document that we participate in providing information called State Funding of Trial Court Representation of Eligible Persons. I don't think you have it before you, but Robin will make it available to you.
Madam Chair, I did put that website.
And Representative Hannah, so I could tell your constituents, and by the way, I'm happy to come to any meetings you want to go with to explain this to constituents, is that of the 21 states that have a state-funded system, Oregon is 20th in caseload growth, in terms of caseload cost. I'm sorry. So we are, our costs over a period, I think it was from about 1982 to 1997, and it looks about the same, is really less than most comparable states. And I think I'd like Catherine now to speak to this. We estimate a 1.5% caseload growth per biennium. Is that right, Catherine, in your projection?
For the record, it's Catherine Aylward. Yes, that is correct. 1.5% caseload growth per year.
So, Representative Hann, I guess my response to your constituents would be it's not a 12% growth. That's not what they're looking for. If you want to make an investment in this function, and I can make all the arguments why that would be important, it's probably not this session. And then we're talking about what is the essential maintenance budget. And I think it's clear to all of you on the committee, while we'd like to have control over that, we don't. That demand for cases is controlled by police and prosecutors primarily. They drive our business, and we're simply the recipients of that business. And so whatever, and this takes us to the conversation I had with the committee some time ago about right-sizing. And, of course, I thought the Judicial Department's presentation at the end, I recall Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, quoting Representative Hanna, said, well, would you please help us, or do you want an Air Force guy and a bottler, Coca-Cola bottler from Roseburg making these decisions? And my answer to that, if you ask me that about, you know, where are the cuts, and, of course, you have to reduce the demands by changing the criminal code or eliminating statutory rights to counsel, as my materials indicated, very hard decisions. Indeed, my answer would be, yes, I want the Air Force guy and the bottler from Roseburg making those decisions. Now, I'm happy to consult with you, but you are the people's representatives. And to make this right-sized, in other words, to make us be able to function with the money you give us, you can't, I would respectfully submit, allow the demand to exceed the supply of defenders. You have to turn off the spigot somehow. If you can't turn off the spigot, if you can't have that conversation, Representative Hanna, with your fellow businessmen and women in Roseburg, which you would have, for example, in the area of public parks, you're having conversations, I assume, with the voters and saying, you're going to have to pay your way into the public parks because we don't have any money. The conversation you'd have to have with your citizens and your business colleagues in Roseburg would be, you have to do some of the public safety stuff yourself. You have to put in alarm systems. You have to maybe deal with financial fraud and theft internally because we don't have the money. That's tremendously a difficult conversation for you all to have with the public. I'm not suggesting it, but what I am suggesting is indeed the Air Force guy and the Coca-Cola executive are exactly the right ones to make that decision. And unfortunately, the Public Defense Services Commission, just like the Judicial Department, can't make those decisions for you. So it comes back to right-sizing. Whether you upsize or downsize the public safety system, you have to right-size us.
Senator Wentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just reminded me of another driver that we tend not to think about, and that is when there is high unemployment, which we have in Oregon, that also tends to have an impact on the public safety system as well as the other social service systems that we have in Oregon. And so, you know, looking at some of those variables that are involved, I think you can probably look at some trend lines and see where you're going to get some increases and some spikes in arrest and prosecution by the mere fact that we have a significant number of individuals who are not employed. The other thought that came to me, because I did have an opportunity once some time ago to attend a presentation where I believe it was Maryland. It was one of the eastern states, and I think Justice Carlson knew where I'm going, where the prosecution was delayed, and you had an individual who languished in the jail, and he had been he was in for murder, and they released him because of not the speedy prosecution, nor was the representation there, and I think that message never left me when I was back there at that conference, that there is this whole issue of speedy trial. There's this whole, that we are constitutionally required to provide. And then there is the other piece that we have no control over, because if we don't do it, then here you have the Ninth Circuit Court that weighs in and say, so the decision-making for us, I think, is going to have to weigh all of those particular issues, and none of them, I think, are going to be fun.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, very true, the dynamics of this public safety system, of course, all the other systems that you're, as legislators, having to preside over are equally complex, but there's all kinds of variables, that, some of which you pointed to. Another one that's a very big dynamic is the graduates from the prison system. With Ballot Measure 11, I know when I worked for the federal prosecutor, we were tracking the violent Ballot Measure 11 graduates and gang leaders who are coming out of the institutions back to the community. That's a dynamic. So as these folks age and come back to the community, you've got an impact in crime that we've already laid the foundation for that. So again, our business may increase, because back to my comment, Madam Chair, to Representative Hanna, what really drives the cost over time in Oregon has been the complexity of the cases, Representative Hanna. We have a very high proportion of felonies to misdemeanors, so the more serious cases drive our costs. And the other thing, it turns out, as Ms. Lamont tracked in this paper, is we file a lot of cases. As the Chief said to you before, not only civil cases, but criminal cases. Our prosecutors do a very good job of filing lots of criminal cases, more than per capita than most states. So that's another reason why our budget is being driven. So these are the dynamics that drive our budget.
If at some point you would comment on the methamphetamine epidemic and how we should be looking at that as it relates to this whole discussion around providing defense services. I'd be interested to hear your
Madam Chair, I'm happy to now. You're anticipating, I think, the conclusion of my but I'll happy to do it now, which was,
we'll go to you, Senator, after that.
Whether you upsize or downsize, you have to right-size. And the best as I can see is just one citizen among many, or one now public official among many. It looks like you're going to be asked to upsize, increase the public safety system in response to methamphetamine. And what that means is, you don't, last I recall, hire police officers, but I think somebody's asking you to hire special prosecutors to more aggressively prosecute methamphetamine cases, which I think is a fine, speaking as a private citizen, a fine strategy, as long as it's balanced with treatment and other things that I'm sure you're considering, because locking people up with drug problems is only one strategy, and perhaps a short-sighted one for the addicts. But if you, for example, decide to employ more prosecutors, well, you know where the next shoe falls. Guess what? We need to hire more defenders. And those cases are probably going to be reasonably complex, because if the prosecutors are doing their job, they're going to look for the big fish. They're going to look for methamphetamine conspiracies. Those cases are hard to prosecute. They're complicated to defend. So I would say there would be, Madam Chair, a comparable cost that you would have to consider when you at least upsize that portion of the public safety system. And I assume, I'll put a period on it at that point, Madam Chair. I think you have another question.
Yeah, I do. Do you see in the discussions that have been taking place up to this date around methamphetamine and the need for increased enforcement, et cetera, are you hearing that balanced approach being addressed, or is it more one-sided on the enforcement side, directed to the enforcement side?
Well, Madam Chair, I hesitate to speak as Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission because we haven't discussed it, but I'll certainly speak if I assume you're asking me as a former federal prosecutor and having worked in areas what I think. I'm
very
don't think
much aware of your expertise in a number of areas.
At least experience, I don't know about expertise, but I was, by the way, on the governor's interim task force. I wasn't on the methamphetamine component. I was on the sentencing. And my own judgment, what I thought you were entitled to ask from us was if we added cost and increased upside the public safety system, our task force should have proposed ways that we could reduce the public safety system in some other areas. So I propose that, for example, if you were going to ask the legislature to upsize the public safety system to deal with methamphetamine, that as the experts, which is what the Air Force guy and the Coca-Cola executives were asking for, what do the experts say, that it was incumbent upon us to propose some cuts. I think the vote was 30-2. I was in the minority, too, with some legislators. In other words, they didn't want to examine the offsetting costs. Now, directly to answer your question, unfortunately, many of you have been here longer than I have, and you see that enforcement, which I always think is very important, seems to capture the limelight and the attention. And it is, I think it looks to me like, but I haven't looked at the budget, I'm worried that there isn't the balance between treatment and prevention and prosecution. I think it's really a three-legged stool, all of which have to be addressed. The problem is you have very little funding, and maybe you're going to be asked to pick one of those three legs of the stool. So do you spread your money an inch deep and a mile wide, or do you target it? That's a question you have to ask, too. And I'm sorry to say that's as much as impression I can give on that.
Well, I appreciate not only the response, but the candor, and Senator Devlin and then Senator Winters.
One of the things I wanted to get on the record was what happened in the last session in this committee. And I think part of it that was much different is that the system was broken. It wasn't working. We were deferring prosecution. The courts were deferring appointing counsel. We had the governor's budget, but then we had I think we still had another forecast or that was down below where the governor was. And then we had a co-chair's budget, which literally nobody liked in the building. I mean, it literally was nobody liked it. Even the co-chairs didn't really particularly like the budget. But we were given direction in the committee that we had $85 million more than the co-chair's budget to make the system work, plus whatever we could get additional out of criminal fines and assessments and filing fees and surcharges. And that $85 million ultimately became part of the tax package that passed both chambers and ultimately by the referendum process was turned down by the voters. But that's a very different scenario than what we have here. One, we're not actually broken yet, again. And two, nobody is telling us we have additional dollars to fill these holes. But I wanted to point out another side of this just so it doesn't sound entirely negative. There were a couple of things that I still remember from both the testimony and our discussion last time. One was, I think it was a district attorney, I can't remember for sure, that brought us an example of where a person, their prosecution was going to be deferred, and they were not going to be held. And they basically said, me? You're not holding me? You know what my record is? You're not holding me? Which was kind of a wake-up call to the committee about, you know, the public policy implications of this. The other thing is when we did that massive list of prioritization, when we ran out of money in terms of what was in the co-chair's budget for a public defense, I think one of the lines that became really questionable is whether we would prosecute first-time DUIs. And that became a not politically very not palatable issue of not prosecuting DUIs. So we figured out we had to fund at a higher level than that. But I think the discussion that we have now is we don't want the system to break. Nobody's telling us we have additional dollars. In fact, they're telling us we may not have the dollars that are already in the governor's budget for some of these items. We got a lot of difficult choices to make, and I guess we might even have to ask you for your guidance if we're not going to spin the soup of where we actually cut in terms of other programs if we're going to get you to that essential level or anywhere close to that level, because that may be the scenario we have to go in the direction of.
Well, I guess I'm kind of struggling with your description of where we are. Mr. Ozan started off with a description that says this is a system where if you liken it to the plane,
yeah.
Remember the plane?
Yes.
Headed toward the trees?
Well, I'm looking in front of you. Look for the clear cuts. To look for the clear cuts.
Madam Chair, I'm willing to take a stab at it right now. Again, I think we tried to do it in our budget documents, and the answers aren't easy. First of all, hold our feet to the fire. If you can see efficiencies and efforts that we're not making as an agency, I don't know what they are, because between Catherine and my colleagues on my management team and the board of directors, I think we are doing everything we can think of to making this a better, more effective system. With the money we have, we're making those lawyers perform at optimum. If you can find, you know, the old proverbial fraud, fat, and waste, let's talk about that. So that's one thing. I don't think there's much there, but I'm happy to look at that with you, and that's certainly what you want to look at. The second thing is back to this very tough conversation. I mentioned in a footnote in my materials about the price of government. I know all of you are reading it now, and the question is for you, fortunately, and not me, for you as my elected representative, all this is here, you have to make choices between government functions. Health care, schools, public safety. Let me back up before I get to that point and say, what about the right to counsel? What can we do about narrowing the right to counsel? Because we pay for lawyers in cases where there's a right to counsel. And we have in one of our exhibits here, and I won't go through it now, but we've listed in one of the appendix those rights to counsel which are based on statute and not the Constitution, state and federal. Most of the rights that we pay for lawyers for are constitutional, but some are statutory. They're your choice. So you can look at those. At almost every session that I've been around, you have looked at them, and the most notable one is post-conviction relief, which is a second form of appeal that lawyers that we pay for do to check about after the first appeal is exhausted. The defendant can come back and say, I have a challenge that didn't appear in the transcript before the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. It typically is, my lawyer was incompetent. In the secrecy of our conference, the lawyer told me such and such, and he couldn't produce, or he misled me. And that goes up as one of the issues on post-conviction relief. There are other kinds of things. The prosecutor hid some evidence, something like that. That's a statutory right to counsel in those proceedings. When the legislature starts thinking about abolishing those kinds of rights to counsel that are statutory, you wind up finding out that there are countervailing costs that outweigh the savings to indigent defense. And in the case of post-conviction relief, it is the costs to the attorney general and the trial and appellate courts of trying to proceed with a client who doesn't have a lawyer, because there is a right for this kind of appeal. It's just, is there a right to counsel? So these people will go pro se, and their case will be a mess for the lawyers to sort out. So you wind up, this is just an example, thinking you're going to save some money to our budget by abolishing the statutory right to counsel, and it turns out in most of the cases I've seen, there's not the savings. So then it becomes, look at the lion's share of the budget, constitutional rights. How are you going to reduce those? Well, there is the tough political question. And you have to ask yourself, how important is public safety to the health and safety of my constituents compared to schools, higher education, health? And you can start reducing the demands for constitutional right to counsel. You can drop certain offenses to violations, which is not a crime and doesn't give rise to the right to counsel. Or you can decriminalize certain matters. Now, I know you know how tough that conversation is. That's where you're going to have to make those decisions. After you've squeezed every drop of excess in my budget, looked at the statutory rights to counsel, then you have to have that price of government function. What am I going to tell my voters is the priority that I'm carrying forward for Oregon? And I think public safety has to be very high. And that's why it's very difficult to have this conversation. We're going to offload some things on you folks to do for yourselves, which we do now in the public safety system. So I don't see, frankly, much of a way out. Senator Devlin, back to you. It's a very tough question. We will go throughout this session with you and talk about each right to counsel, maybe during phase two,
And each crime, and you'll certainly want to have those conversations with prosecutors and police, and where the advantages are. Let me just give you, Catherine pointed out one today. Let me have you look in an exhibit here, Appendix G, if you would. Appendix G.
And while we're looking, let's do plan on having that more thorough discussion in phase two. We need to do that.
Thank you. And I will just a brief digression, Madam Chair. I just want to show you how powerful your policy options are, or your policy decisions. On page G4, there are two grids there. The second one is in the lower half of page G4. Let's wait for everybody to... G4, and that's entitled Traffic Felony Cases, Driving While Suspended or Revoked. Look what happened in 1999 when the legislature changed the Oregon laws with regard to what we sometimes call defelonizing driving while suspended. Look what happened to our caseload by that policy decision. That's the kind of gains there are if you can find the kinds of offenses where your constituents will say, look, we do want to pay a little more for schools and public safety. And gee, so there's an example of the kinds where you can affect our caseload and you can make some savings. Beyond that, and none of these decisions are easy. I'm just saying that's where the decisions lie, it seems to me. Well, I don't...
That was a good one. Give us some more like that.
Madam Chair, I...
The presentation of data and experience with the data can make a huge difference in how we look at our options. Please continue.
Well, since the committee has taken me very properly to the bottom line, I don't want to drone on about some matters that, and I think you've read, it's pretty clear you've read the materials. Perhaps I can go to page 10 and just talk to you a little about some of the things that we did this first biennium under the commission's management and with a new management team to show you that, you know, one of the things I wanted to do, aside from provide you with information, is kind of build your confidence level in us. You know, if you give us some money, will we waste it or will we manage it? And you might think of us as just a bunch of lawyers who tell you what the demand is and said, just give us the money. And we're really not. I mean, some of the people like John Yunker and Mike Greenfield, who have been state managers, tell me, Peter, you're a manager of funds, the commission is. You've got to manage things effectively, not just come to the legislature and say, you know, we have 300,000 cases, give us the money. What are we doing to improve the system? So starting in July of 2003, when we really took the whole public defense system, contracting and the appellate, into two divisions, what did we do? Well, on page 10, under what I call service delivery challenges in 03 and 05, we formed a new agency. We had an entirely new management team. The commission hired me, and I hired or promoted people like Catherine with a lot of talent in the agency. We have a new management team. Representative Hannah, you were asking about turnover in the legal services division, that 25-lawyer office. We had to hire 5 new lawyers during this. Some went naturally. Others probably looked at some of the handwriting on the wall because we were managing things differently. So we lost 5 and need to hire 5. Bullet 3 under forming a new agency, we took over the contracting, the payment, and the administration functions from the Judicial Department. We pay for lawyers now. We pay expenses. And by the way, I just had my annual evaluation as the commission evaluates me as a director. And it's really an evaluation of how the agency is doing, how Catherine's people are doing, handling the attorney bills and approving, reviewing, and paying expenses. And we got nothing but accolades. The lawyers said things are good. The judges said things are going well. So we took over a whole new administrative function in 03-05, and we're doing it very well, I think. And we're doing it in a centralized way. Before, it was all 36 counties with the circuit courts making decisions. And based on the wisdom of the legislature in creating this organization, we're now centralizing that decision, and we're saving money in the process.
Senator Winters has a question.
A question in the management process. What degree of scrutiny is done by the court to determine whether an indigent attorney is needed or necessary or required?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think it's a significant degree of scrutiny. I know from listening and talking with you that there have been cases where questions have arisen, and they are, frankly, the ones that keep me up at night. And I have to say to you honestly, they will always be there. I mean, it's like auditing the IRS or people slipping through the cracks. It will happen. But the court has a verification staff that interviews people, asks questions about their financial background, follows up on the application form they fill out, and in my judgment and the judgment of people who have been at it a long time, do a very good job of reviewing those cases and determining eligibility. So we think we're doing it well. We think we're doing it as well as can be expected with the staff we have. I think we're doing a very good job. But I can't tell you, and I think over time, hopefully if we're both here for a while, there won't be cases where people will receive appointed counsel that don't deserve it. Now, when the prosecutors, and Barnes Ellis and I have met with the prosecutors, we communicate with them regularly, they're always saying, we don't want to see violations. My view is, if it can be established that someone has taken funds when they're not legally entitled, I've told the prosecutors, prosecute that violation of the law.
For the record, I believe it was Senator Harper who raised the question during one of the e-board sessions because his son,
yes.
In fact, he raised it and had been given an attorney, which he felt was not necessary or required, and that's what prompted the question of what kind of scrutiny does exist.
Madam Chair, members, I should just point out that there is a Secretary of State audit underway of the Judicial Department at this point, looking at how eligibility is verified.
And the due date on that audit?
Madam Chair, I do not know.
If we could find out, yes, it would be good to have that in phase two, if at all possible.
Madam Chair, I just want to go back a little bit, because on the question of delayed action and methamphetamine, because as everybody knows, that's probably one of my passions. But and that I agree with you that you can't just do the prosecution, that you have to do treatment and putting people back up, particularly families back together, and that you have to determine what level we're going to be involved in. In 99, if I recall, in 99, I started to discuss this issue, and it has accelerated and become a lot more severe in Oregon since then. If we further delay, what is your thought on what really the impacts will be for Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Winter, unless strange things happen on their own from time to time, but I wouldn't wish it here, people's habits around the abuse of tobacco change, there's different attitudes about the use of drugs in general. I don't see that happening spontaneously with methamphetamine. Sometimes the drug is so dangerous and fatal that the word gets out on the street that we better stop doing this. I don't think that's going to happen. So I think the health and safety of Oregonians is going to be severely compromised unless there are aggressive law enforcement and treatment campaigns undertaken. So as a citizen, I would wholeheartedly support aggressive action. My only comment, as having focused on gun violence as a federal prosecutor, I would urge the legislature to make sure that law enforcement catches the big fish. If you give a lot of money, don't let law enforcement fill the net up with little minnows. We've got to focus on the prosecution, targeted prosecution, where the impact is big, and not, again, waste your valuable money. But I think it's a serious problem, and we'll get more serious without intervention.
Currently, we have situations in communities where you have law enforcement who actually are arresting individuals, and those that are selling and what have you, and they're back in their communities. So are those the fish that you're talking about? Are you talking about what level of the big fish are you looking at? I'd like to know what the size of the bass is.
Madam Chair, Senator Winter, without having studied this problem myself, I can only speculate, but those
those ones that that are the low-hanging fruit that police pick up in, for example, Old Town in Portland and whatever comparable in Salem, maybe cruising felony flats, and they pick up sales and use, those are the minnows. They're not the big manufacturers. The big fish were the ones that came through Portland International Airport the other day with saddlebags full of methamphetamine. And the strategy, the prosecution, that I believe you have to ask prosecutors, the law enforcement, is to develop a comprehensive strategy that targets those big fish and not spend your money on the street dealers. Now, the street dealers and the users need treatment, but you're never going to cut off the supply by focusing on the small fish.
Well, I know we have here that it's not in felony flats. You know, we're seeing at a lot of socioeconomic levels here in this community, and also where you have individual who hasn't set up in Salem and one in Lincoln City. Is that a small operator that can have both an outlet in several cities?
That doesn't sound like it. No, that sounds like the big fish that I think you ought to catch, or law enforcement ought to catch.
Thank you. And he just reminded me that my passion is combating meth.
It's not meth.
It's not meth.
Good point.
Would you like to continue?
Well, I was talking about some of the things that we've done as a new agency, and I was talking about the merging of functions that had been performed by the Judicial Department with our new Contract and Business Services Division, and you see them listed there. Item two, what I wanted to talk about, was really generally improving the legal and administrative services in our agency. I wanted to talk a little about what I think is really an accomplishment. This is on page 11, item number two. We've talked some about the Legal Services Division and the large caseload in the appellate courts. When we started out in 2003 looking at that agency, and when I was hired, my only authority was over the State Public Defender's Office. We hadn't yet got the contract function. I looked at that office of 25 lawyers, and though there are many good lawyers that are working hard, we couldn't quite figure out what they were doing in the sense of their productivity. In private law practice, the coin of the realm is the billable hour. Sometimes it's abused. It's certainly annoying to clients. But when I send you a bill as a private lawyer, you look at that bill and those hours, and you either tell me I didn't earn it or not. And my function in the agency is measured by the amount of revenue I generate. How do you replicate that in a public law office? Well, our managers at the Legal Services Division, these are former colleagues of existing lawyers, developed a measurement system that ranked the difficulty of appeals, judged how many cases were on each lawyer's caseload, and asked each lawyer to develop a work plan for the year. And as a result of what I call that's hand-to-hand management, you're really looking at former colleagues and friends, and you're telling them, we've got to manage what you do, we've got to measure what you do. And as a result, as I've indicated on page 11, between September 2003 and January 2004, we reduced the backlog by 34% just by instilling these performance standards and work plans in our lawyer core.
Now, Mr. Ozan, is that information, is that detail related to the third bullet at the top of that page where you talk about developing new performance-based personnel rules, employee evaluation systems, and performance measures for both divisions? Is there a relationship?
Yes, definitely. So, Madam Chair, I was going to start off, and I should back up and show you just by reference, because we're quite proud of it, and we don't have time to go through it now, but on Appendix A is our strategic plan for 2005-07. It says at the top, draft, that was before the commission at its recent meeting adopted the strategic plan. And this is another way of answering your question, Madam Chair. The strategic plan sets out the tasks or goals for a biennium. We had one last session, the last biennium, and we have a new one. And we ask each employee to be familiar with that strategic plan
And when they develop their work plan and performance measures, they should relate to that strategic plan. And so, Madam Chair, when I mentioned that we asked the individual lawyers to develop a work plan, one of our goals in our strategic plan was the reduction of the appellate backlog. In other words, deliver quality, cost-efficient services. And we asked each employee to think about how their work plan would advance the strategic plan. Similarly, each of my management team members, Catherine, Peter Gartland, who runs this division, myself, Ingrid Swenson, who many of you know, we all have work plans. So our strategic plan is really the marching orders for each of us in the management team. So we are trying to hardwire, if you will, the performance evaluation system of each employee to the overall strategic plan. And then when we met, just to add, and I know it's a subject we want to talk about here, performance measures. As a new agency, we were asked by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee to come up with performance measures. We were already committed, by the way, to do that, but the legislature told us to do it last session. And we've now developed performance measures that are integrated into the strategic plan. Maybe it's a good point of departure to talk about our performance measures, which I know it's key for you. And let's see, we've got 10 minutes.
I think this is a good place to segue and understanding that, you know, we won't make our way all the way through. But what you're keying in on now is strategy 3 of your overall goals and strategies for 0507. Your strategy 3 is laid out on page A7, which is to develop and refine performance measurements which assure the Legislative Assembly that the Public Defense Services Corporation and OP, what's that?
That's the Office of Public Defense Services, which is is my office.
Are spending and managing state funds cost effectively. That's where we want to key in.
Very good. Madam Chair, first of all, let me say performance measures are a work in progress. Last biennium, we were yet to appear before JLAC, so then it said, go to JLAC.
Joint Legislative Audit Committee.
I owe you. Catherine could not save me from myself.
Twice.
Piggy. $2. I have lots of dollars in my wallet. In 2003-05, we were anticipating going to the Audit Committee, so then the strategy said develop. Now it says refine, but it just said develop. Just to bring you up to date, Madam Chair, we appeared before the Legislative Audit Committee in October of last year after we had conversations with them and the Judiciary Committee, and they've approved a set of performance measures. Senator Devlin is on that committee, and remember some of the conversation we have. I think in the time, just to give you a prelude, I don't know, Madam Chair, whether we will be back tomorrow or whether...
Yes.
So... let me just focus on one that's on page A8. Under goal 2 on the previous page, A7, it says assure the quality of public defense services, and then the strategy is continue to develop quality assurance standards and programs to improve public defense services across the state. And below that strategy on page A8, is performance measure number 6. This was a key performance measure to give the legislature a sense of how are we doing with the basic function of public defense. And let me back up and explain a little about it. When I think we first appeared before Senator Devlin's committee, I think I made the mistake of having what was, in my judgment, I should have an open-ended conversation with the committee to think through the very difficult issues that public defense poses for performance measures. I mean, do we measure recidivism? Do we measure crime rate? Do we measure number of acquittals? How do we get at a measure that will assure you that we're performing our function well? And we had a rather robust and, I think, to the committee, somewhat unsatisfying discussion, because I should have shared with the committee
already what I had in the way of ideas. We'd gone to Harvard's Kennedy School, talked to them about public defense functions. I talked to the UCLA Medical School, who a doctor and lawyer there who's an expert on public defense management. And it turned out what we've come up with now is probably the cutting edge of a public defense system for assuring the delivery of quality services. What we had to ask ourselves was what, and there are a number of measures here, and I'm just focusing on public performance measure number 6. How could we assure to you all, as stewards of the funding, that the money you give us will actually result in effective public defense service? And we thought about all the options. We had conversations with JLAC. There we go again. Sorry, Miss Piggy, with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee.
She likes to be fed.
I know. And we decided, you know, the way to assure that we're doing our job right, that we're delivering cost-effective quality services, is to actually go out and inspect over time every contractor in the state of any significant size. And that's what we're doing. And this is where we're leading the nation right now of any state public defense system. Because we only have essentially 6 people to manage the contracts in-house, state employees, and another 5 to make payments, we have to depend on volunteer lawyers. So what we have done is we've set up a site visit process as our lead quality assurance performance measurement. And we said that if this performance measure shows progress, you can be assured that you're getting what you paid for in public defense.
How did you set the 30% target for performance measure 6?
Well, we just started in the end of 2003, and 30% of contractors with 10 or more attorneys. And we said, what is humanly possible? We've got Ingrid Swenson staffing this, and we're taking 6 or 7 busy public defense managers and lawyers and asking them to go. For example, this week we've got a team going to Jackson County, and we're looking at the contractors down there. And they're spending 3 days. They're talking to judges, lawyers, prosecution and defense, court...
Court-appointed
special advocates, citizen review boards, corrections professionals, and asking them, how are our contractors doing in Jackson County? In other words, a 360-degree evaluation. We interview them. We interview the employees in the office. Then they report back to me, and they report to the director of that office with 10 or more lawyers on how that office is doing, what their problems are, and, most importantly, to what extent have they adopted best practices in public defense management? Do they have an independent board like my commission to advise them? Do they have regular reviews of management like I get? Do they have regular evaluations of their employees like we do? Do they have financial and fiscal systems in place that make it a business, a functioning business? Do they survey on a regular basis the stakeholders in their community? Do they have a way of fielding complaints? And over time, as we do these site visits, we will be able to report to you, in this case you asked, Madam Chair, in 2007, 30% we will visit, and to what extent are those 30%, have they adopted best practices? And we will develop a specific list of them as we proceed. And to what extent have they addressed the problems that were identified by that site visit team? So what we think, performance measure 6, is one of our crucial performance measures, assuring you that as state managers, we are providing cost-effective quality services. Now, it's a huge undertaking, and when I said we're guesstimating that we can do 30%, we're depending on these volunteer lawyers to continue to participate. So far, they've been inspired to participate. They've said, I feel honored to be asked, and I learn a lot by going on these site visits. I take them back to my office, and I'm a better business person myself. So far, it's a success.
From your response, it's clear to me what you will be measuring or what the components are within that the process of measurement. but again, how you arrived at the target, the 30%, was, you know, just a guess.
I think I have to say I hesitate to use the word guess. I would like to say an educated guess. I guess I'd qualify it.
But it wasn't 40% and it wasn't 60%. So somehow you said it's 30 because.
Yeah, Catherine's just whispering to me. We, from our short experience thus far, Madam Chair, we've done about two a year. I hope we can do more. So when you count up the total number, we extrapolate to a year, that's where we get. You'll see we have two targets, and I should have explained that too. When the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, I'll get that right, talked to us about performance measures as a new agency, we had a 2005 or 2007 target, and the committee said, no, put it 2014. Give yourself a chance to collect data. Now we hear from, understandably, members of your committee that you wanted us to try to come up with a shorter target. So for the purposes of this committee, we tried as best we could to anticipate what we could do in 2007. Now, I want to get to 100% very fast because I want to impress all of you of the work we're doing. So I'm going to make it work as fast as I can, but it's got to be credible. So that was our calculus, as Catherine says. Two a year, that's where we are.
Ms. Lamont has also whispered in my ear, shared some information that the co-chairs also, the co-chairs of Ways and Means, also weighed in on the setting of this particular target.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when I reviewed the performance measures with the co-chairs, they asked for a shorter time frame, a shorter target time frame, even though the Joint Legislative Audit Committee did direct them to come up with a longer time frame for their target. So,
and Madam Chair, I'm pleased to say that the leadership of your committee, Senator Schrader, is on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and Representative Susan Morgan. So we worked with them, again, brainstorming what's the best way to measure our function. And, of course, I appreciate the fact that they wanted to hold us to a shorter target, and I'm happy to do that. With more experience, our targets will get less of guesstimates and better projections.
Again, you've helped us unpack the reasoning behind the target. We're right at 3 o'clock. Senator Beverly, can your question hold, or is it something
we need to... Are we coming back to them tomorrow?
We are coming back tomorrow.
Okay. They can hold till then.
Anything else for the good?
And we'll come back to performance measures.
We will be coming
I'm
back
sure.
to performance measures
like
and the rest of the presentation. This has been a very thoughtful presentation this afternoon.
Appreciated all the questions.
Chairman Ellis, again, thank you very much for your participation with us today. Chief, thank you for introducing.
Madam Chair, I just want to remind committee members to bring their Department of Public Safety standards and training notebook tomorrow. If there is time, sufficient time, we'll get started with them also.
Okay. We are adjourned, and thank you.
Can you wait for this moment?